We're studying in the 19th chapter of 2 Samuel, and last time we left off at the third verse. In this passage, we find that David's army has now just gained the victory over Absalom's forces, those that had usurped the throne and had deposed David and had set up a new king and a new government, have been soundly defeated by the forces of David. But one thing David wanted to try to prevent was to prevent the death of Absalom. However, Absalom was killed in this battle. Joab saw to it that Absalom did die. He got his head caught in a giant tree. He hung there, and he was defenseless. And Absalom thrust him through the heart with 3 darts, and then he was surrounded by 10 men and slain with the sword. And when the news does finally get to David, David goes into an unusually deep state of mourning and grief because of Absalom's death. And since David is grieving so deeply, since David is taking the news so hard, then this has a profound effect upon all of his followers. All of those soldiers who had so valiantly fought and defended David and had routed the forces that had usurped the kingdom, they now, instead of celebrating a victory, instead of coming home, back to the city where David is in Mahanaim, in a very victorious and a glad setting, they come back with sadness because of the great sadness that David has. And so verse 3 says, "And the people gat them by stealth that day into the city, as people being ashamed to steal away when they flee in battle." They just kind of were sneaking back home as though they'd done something wrong, as though they had some reason to be ashamed of their actions, and it was simply because of this profound and actually misplaced grief that David had. And so, verse 4 describes the situation with David. "But the king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, 'O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son.'" Now we can imagine, maybe, how deep this grief was of David's. Although it was misplaced, it was really abnormally great for the occasion. Nevertheless, David felt it just as strongly as ever. It's a very real thing to David. It has a profound effect upon David. And we see that David then can have no energy, no time, no thoughts for anything else except for the fact that he's lost his son. And of course, any parent that has lost a son can certainly feel with David. They can certainly be able to sympathize and empathize with this man upon this occasion. And so we see here that David definitely does have the ability to feel grief and sorrow and pain. And he shows it here. Just the very words that are stated in this fourth verse. "He cried with a loud voice." It wasn't anything that he kept into himself, but he gave a loud cry. "Oh, my son Absalom. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." And this was so well known among those that were in the city that it also had a very deep, profound effect upon them. They felt as though they might have done something wrong in winning this victory, because as a result of it, Absalom had been put to death. But let us remember now that Absalom was a traitor. Absalom was a murderer. Absalom was a person that had rebelled not only against the authority of the land, but against the authority of his own father. He'd gone against the priests. He'd gone against everything that God had set up here in the kingdom of Israel. Absalom had gone against it, and he'd been plotting and planning this for a long time. It wasn't something that just happened on the spur of the moment. And so he truly was bad at heart. He truly was a person that had premeditated this terrible, terrible wrong that he'd done. And so even though he is David's son, David should be able to see that he was simply a man that had been killed because of his own actions, because of his own wicked deeds, and that he deserved to die. If anybody else ever deserved to die, Absalom certainly deserved to do so. And so we have a profound grief on the part of David, but yet it is a misplaced grief for a certain to a certain extent, because Absalom was so wicked. And so in verse 5, we see then that Joab, the captain of the army, the nephew of David, the son of David's sister, he decides to step in and take matters into his own hands. Here, this thing seems to have gone too far. This grief of David is putting a damper upon all of his followers. The whole city is not able to even function normally because David is so profoundly in this state of grief. Everyone is feeling as though they may not even have a good cause here in helping David. So Joab comes in, and maybe Joab does usurp more authority than he should have. He probably says things that were beyond his scope of power so far as his political position goes. But nevertheless, he does do it, and it seems to have the right effect. So verse 5, "And Joab came into the house to the king and said, Thou hast shamed this day the faces of all thy servants, which this day have saved thy life, and the lives of thy sons and thy daughters, and the lives of thy wives, and the lives of thy concubines." So he just tells David like it is. David, you have put to shame the people that have done the most good for you. The ones that have done the things that you needed to have done. They've saved your life, as well as the lives of all of your families, your sons and daughters and wives and concubines. These people are people that have done the things that you needed to have done. They've saved you, and here you're shaming them. You're making them feel badly about what they've done. You're making them think they've done something that they shouldn't have done. And you're making them feel shame when they should be feeling an altogether different sense about this. They should feel like that they've accomplished something good. They should feel like that they have worked for the right cause. But you're making them feel like that they've done something wrong here, and really all that they've done is to save you, you and your family. And so he further elaborates on this in verse 6, "In that thou lovest thine enemies and hatest thy friends, for thou hast declared this day that thou regardest neither princes nor servants. For this day I perceive that if Absalom had lived, and all we had died this day, then it had pleased thee well." You're acting as though we should have all died. If just Absalom had lived, it doesn't matter how the battle came out. It doesn't matter who won, how greatly we were defeated. If every last man that was your follower had died, just if Absalom had lived, that would have pleased thee well. And so he's really putting it on David here. He's telling David in a very plain way that he's not appreciative of what these people have done for him, and that he really is loving his enemies and hating his friends. If David ever had an enemy, it was Absalom. Absalom not only had rebelled against his father and had usurped the throne and had turned the nation against him, but Absalom was coming after him to kill him. And he wasn't going to spare him at all. And so this was his enemy. But David had a love for his enemy, which is not necessarily wrong, but he hated his friends in the process. And so Joab is just telling David very plainly about this. So he says in verse 7, "Now therefore arise and go forth and speak comfortably unto thy servants." The thing for you to do is to stop going through all this terrible grief. Get up, anoint your head, wash your face, and straighten up your clothes, and go and speak to your servants. Speak comfortably unto them. Give them some kind of credit for what they've done. Commend them. Let them know how you feel about them. And this is a necessary thing for you to do. For he says, "For I swear by the Lord, if thou go not forth, there will not tarry one with thee this night, and that will be worse unto thee than all the evil that befell thee from thy youth until now." He said, if you don't go and salvage what you can of your followers now, do it now, they're going to leave you. I swear, he takes an oath here on calling upon the name of the Lord, that if you don't do this now, that this night they're not going to stay. There will not be one that will stay with you. And it seems that Joab may even be implying that he's going to lead these people away, that he's going to unite them into a common force and a common cause to leave the scene where David is and to cease following after David. That seems to be the implication here. For he takes this very strong oath about it. And then he tells David that that'll be worse unto thee than all the evil that befell thee from thy youth until now. Now David had had a lot of evil up to this point from his youth. He had all those years when Saul tried to kill him. He had those times when he'd been ostracized from the nation. He had those times in which he, as a result of his sin, had grief in his own family. One child killing another child. A son raping a daughter. And on and on. And now being deposed from the throne. And so Joab says, what you've had up to this point is not going to be as bad as what you're going to have if you don't straighten up and go out there and comfort these people. Go out and talk to them, tell them how you feel about them, and show some appreciation for the deeds that they've done. So David took this advice. Now we see that David took this dressing down that Joab gave him. He took it in a very meek and humble way. We don't read of any kind of retaliation. We don't read of David saying anything bad to Joab, although this probably did leave a kind of a bad taste in David's mouth. But verse 8 says, then the king arose and sat in the gate. So he got up, left his position and place of mourning. He stopped this loud cry for Absalom, and he sat in the gate, out in a public place where all the people could have access to him. And they told unto all the people, saying, behold, the king doth sit in the gate. The word passes through the city now that here the king is available. He's sitting in the gate. We're still in this city of Mahanaim, over in the very border of Gad. He's not in Jerusalem. He's not back on his throne, but he is now publicly available to his followers in this city, sitting in the gate. And verse 8 further says, and all the people came before the king, for Israel had fled every man to his tent. Now they'd all gone back to their tent, to their place of abode. They were not crowding around the king. They had left the king, and they were ready, according to Joab, to completely abandon the king. But now they came before the king. They came and gave the king an opportunity to express to them his true feelings toward them, to give them some clue as to how he felt about them as his true followers, as those that had hazarded their lives for his benefit. So we see then that this overwhelming and profound grief that David had was rather misplaced, and it did become quite a problem among his immediate followers at Mahanaim. But now that situation seems to have been rectified. David is now back in the good graces of those that are his close followers and those that have fought for him. Now let's see the picture swing over to the rest of the nation, back across the Jordan River among the 10 tribes, and let's see what is happening there about the king and about their feelings toward David. Verse 9 says, and all the people were at strife throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, the king saved us out of the hand of our enemies, and he delivered us out of the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled out of the land for Absalom. So here's a situation. Anyone would think that after David had gained the victory, that the very first thing he would have done would have been to march right straight back to Jerusalem and occupy the throne and again place himself in the position of being the king of Israel. But no, he doesn't do that. David remains away from the throne. David remains in this far-off city of Mahanaim across the Jordan River on the border of Gad, and he waits to see what the nation is going to do. He wants to go back as a king that is welcomed by the people, as a king that is wanted by the people, not as a man who has had to regain and usurp his own throne and do it by force and to force his kingship off on the rest of the nation. He wants the nation to invite him back. Well, when the nation sees that David doesn't come back, when the nation sees that they have a void now, not only do they not have Absalom, they still don't have David either, then they begin to have a discussion among themselves. This is described as a strife among themselves, stating, what should we do? What should our next move be? King David is the one that has been faithful to us, really. He saved us out of the hand of our enemies, and he delivered us out of the hand of the Philistines, but now he's gone. He has left the land because of what Absalom did. And Absalom, whom we anointed over us, is dead in battle. So we don't even have a king, apparently. David's not going to force himself back. He's content to stay away, evidently. And so here we are left as a nation with no king. What should we do? And you can see what a great political debate this would bring about. Now, when you see what kind of political debates happen in some nations, just whenever they're having an election, and it's all orderly, look at the turmoil this nation may have been in when they had one king that had usurped the throne and he was now dead, and the other king was holding off and not coming back, and so it would leave a void, and it would leave a lot of room for a discussion as to what should we do. So they are saying, now therefore, why speak you not a word of bringing the king back? Why is there not a movement? Why is there not a common desire and a petition made to bring the king back? Why are we so silent? Why are we content to be without a king? So we see then that this is a great debate. There's a lot of strife. There's a lot of pros and cons about this thing as to what the move should be of these 10 tribes over there that have been rebellious. What should their next move be? What would be the best course to pursue at this time? And they're trying to decide what to do. Now that we see, though, that David is not completely silent. David is not completely content to leave things like they are. So he starts to manipulate things also through his contacts, the priests. And so verse 11 says, "And King David sent to Zadok and to Abiathar the priests, saying." So these priests had been faithful to David all along. They had been his faithful and trusted friends and acted as spies and given him the information that he needed to get in order to gain the victory. And so he sends to them and asks them to take some action. He says, "Speak unto the elders of Judah, saying, why are ye the last to bring the king back to his house?" Now this seems to imply that this great debate and this strife was primarily among the other nations besides Judah. The other nations were wanting to move to bring David back, but Judah seemed to be doing nothing. Judah, which was the nation that was closest to David, Judah was his own home tribe, they were doing nothing, apparently, to bring David back. And so he asked the priests, Zadok and Abiathar, to speak to the elders and say, "Why are you the last to bring the king back to his house? Why is it that you're doing nothing? You're the last. No one's heard anything from you about this." And he further wants to say, "Seeing the speech of all Israel is come to the king, even to his house." So he'd heard from the rest of the tribes. He knew what the feeling of all the rest of Israel was. They wanted the king back, but he heard nothing from Judah. And so the priests then are to ask the elders, "Why is Judah so silent on this matter? Why has Judah said nothing?" And he further says, through these priests to this tribe of Judah, "Ye are my brethren, ye are my bones and my flesh. Wherefore then are ye the last to bring back the king?" And of course, there's not a good answer at this point for why they didn't go forward with the request that the king come back. Maybe since they were so closely related to David that they had the most shame. Maybe they had the most difficulty in relating to David after what they'd done. And so it was more comfortable for them at this point just to be silent than to break that barrier and say, "Please come back." So this was what these priests were to say to the elders, to stir them to some kind of action. And then in verse 13, he turns to Amasa. "And say ye to Amasa, are thou not of my bone and of my flesh?" Amasa was his nephew, but he had been the captain of Absalom's army. So, but he wants to gain this captain, this man who'd led the forces against him. He wants to gain him to be on his side now. He is his bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. He's his nephew, actually. He's the son of his sister, but he is also a member of the tribe of Judah. Remember, we have a Savior now that is the descendant of David, and we are bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. We partake of his flesh and of his blood. We are a part of him in that sense. We're truly kin to him, and so then we have a special relationship to him as our Savior, just as this tribe of Judah had a special relationship to David. And so here's what he tells to Amasa. "God do so to me and more also if thou be not captain of the host before me," continually in the room of Joab. So he makes the offer. "I'll make you the captain of my host. You'll be in the place of Joab. And I give you an oath to that effect. I swear upon it that I will make you captain of my host in the room or in the place of Joab." Now, he had some reason to not feel too kindly toward Joab. Joab had been the one who had actually gone against his command and had Absalom slain. And Joab, it seems now, is usurping more authority than he should. And David felt this rather keenly, I'm sure. And so now he makes the offer that he'll take another cousin, who's just as closely kin to him as Joab is, and put him in Joab's place. And verse 14 said, "And he bowed the heart of all the men of Judah, even the heart of one man, even as the heart of one man. And they sent this word unto the king, Return thou and all thy servants." So he caused all Judah now to realize that they had been amiss. They should have invited him back sooner. They should have been united in wanting their king to come home. And so they were all as one heart. They were all feeling the sting of David's rebuke. They were feeling the shame of not having asked him back sooner. And so then they as one man sent this word to the king, Return thou and all thy servants. David, we want you back. We need you. We need you to be our king. So verse 15 says, So the king returned and came to Jordan. And Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king and to conduct the king over Jordan. So he came back as far as the Jordan River now. And Judah came as a tribe to meet him and to conduct him over the Jordan River and to bring him back home. So we have things now looking up for the nation. They now have seen their error, and they are asking their king to come back, and he's on the way back home. We're going to close at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friend.